All right. Welcome, everybody. Again, my name is Kyle. I'm one of the pastoral interns here at Peace, and I'm really excited to continue to walk through the life and work of C.S. Lewis with you. If you weren't able to join us last week we walked through the early life of C.S. Lewis, and we looked at how he became a Christian. Not everybody necessarily knows this who's heard of C.S. Lewis, but C.S. Lewis was an atheist, famously, before he became a Christian. Until he was about 32, he was an atheist. He did grow up in a nominal Christian home, but eventually through his schooling and kind of falling into a naturalist, rationalist kind of point of view, he became an atheist, and it wasn't until his 30s that he came back to Christ. And so we walked through that whole process of his early life last week, and the book, Surprised by Joy, we were able to read some from, and it is a really fascinating journey, I think. And so I hope if anybody who was here last week, I hope that you were blessed by at least portions of that book. Even with that book, Lewis, there are some times where he gets really heady and really intellectual, and it can be hard to kind of slog through it. But there are just some really, really cool nuggets of truth in there. So I hope you were blessed by that. This week, we are going to continue on in the story. Now that Lewis has come to Christ as a Christian, we see that his life begins to kind of pick up. It picks up steam, both his career as a writer and as a faculty member at Oxford, but also personally. But before we do that, I want to have you guys at your tables, again, introduce yourselves really quickly, and then ask this question to one another. Who are the people who have influenced you the most, and how? So how have they influenced you, specifically how you think about or relate to God? Okay? Lewis, in particular, was influenced by a lot of people, and we are influenced by Lewis in this class. And so what I want to think about is how we are influenced by specific people. So go ahead. I know I heard a few of you speaking about personal relationships. You know, maybe that was a parent or a youth pastor or a family member. And perhaps some of you mentioned also, you know, people you've read or pastors that you have been under the teachings of. But I think regardless of whether these individuals who influence us, regardless of whether they are personal relationships or whether they're just somebody we're sitting under in teaching or reading, regardless, they influence us in very unique ways. So sometimes, although very rarely, we'll take like the majority of a person's life or character and we'll just say, I want to be like that. But I think most of the time, we're looking at somebody's strengths or somebody's specific characteristics that we admire, and we benefit from those. We seek to embody those. But very rarely do we take the whole person of somebody and seek to be them, right? Because we are still unique, right? And I mean, I think of somebody like, for me, I have a really close relationship with my parents, and they're not here yet, I think, so I can talk about them. I have a unique relationship with them. We're really close, and they've definitely influenced me in some really unique ways. But they also have some things about them that are very frustrating to me, especially as I was a child and I was growing up in their house, right? Now, those things I'm not going to go into detail about, regardless, even though they're not here. But the point is that people generally influence us through their greatest strengths rather than the sum of their person. And so when it comes to figures of history, somebody like Lewis, whether it be learning about them and their life or through their works, it's important for us to pick out what those strengths and or weaknesses might be to allow us to focus our attention on what is helpful for us throughout our lives. We don't want to deify those figures or create for ourselves an idol. And this is true of C.S. Lewis just as much as it is for me and my parents. So I would encourage you, as we continue in our study of Lewis tonight, and as you read Lewis on your own time, to focus on what helps you. What draws you closer to Jesus? What gives you language and pictures and images that help you better understand or communicate the realities of God? Let's focus on those things, and the things that aren't so helpful, we'll leave those ones alone. And we're going to address this specifically with how to read Lewis later tonight. But before we go too much further on our journey into Lewis's life, I want to make a few quick clarifications and notes on last week's class when we traveled through Surprised by Joy. Lewis's conversion was an intellectual process, right? If you were here last week, we walked through how his thinking changed over time as he was influenced by books and by personal relationships. His thinking about God and his thinking about reality changed. And this is a reflection of who Lewis was, right? He was an intellectual person. He's a faculty member at Oxford. You have to be pretty intellectual to be a faculty member at Oxford. And so for Lewis, this is how God worked in his life. He broke down the intellectual walls around Lewis's heart that he had built up to protect himself from a God who would command obedience. And not every Christian's experience looks like C.S. Lewis's. Not every Christian's experience with God is an intellectual journey. One of the great beauties of our God is that he, as a personal creator, knows us intimately, and he knows how best to reveal himself to us. Revealing himself to Lewis through an intellectual journey made complete sense because that's who Lewis was. And it makes sense to me that he revealed himself first to me through a story, because I love stories. That's who I am. It makes sense to others that they would see God first through gradual instances of Christians living out their faith, right? Christians showing love to them. There's lots of stories of people coming to Christ because Christians just over and over and over again loved on them. But each person's encounter with Jesus looks different. And sometimes it's a long journey, like Lewis's was. Sometimes it's a really sudden, quick occurrence. So I don't want us to look at Lewis's life and say, okay, well, that must be the way that God is going to work in our lives. But what it should do is it should give us confidence that God uses even the smallest of encounters to build a bridge through which he will eventually draw us to salvation. So in your own interactions with people, I just want to encourage you. Owen Barfield did not know that his idea of chronological snobbery was going to be this huge foundational block for Lewis to understanding the realities of God. J.R.R. Tolkien didn't know that this middle-of-the-night talk that they had about Christianity being a true myth was going to be a tipping point for Lewis to embrace Christ. And the authors that he read, George MacDonald and G.K. Chesterton, they were so influential in opening up his imagination to a spiritual reality, but they had no idea they were having that effect on him. And yet God used them profoundly. And he uses you profoundly in ways you may not know and might not ever know, right? This is, Lewis is a great example of what Paul says when he says, I planted the seed and Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. And so I hope that the story of Lewis grants you confidence in your relationships with the people you love, that you don't have to have some profound spiel or charismatic nature to spread the gospel. You just have to love Christ, love people, and be faithful to his calling to you. And he will use you as he sees fit. Now, with that being said, I want to move now from Lewis's conversion in 1932, he was 34 years old, to his prolific works from there on out. Lewis died in 1963, so 1932 to 1963, we've got about 30 years of his life. And we're not going to cover all of those years tonight, but what we are going to do is we're going to start to look at how his work would be engulfed by his faith and the idea that Christianity could satisfyingly combine reason and intellect with imagination and story. The book of the day, I hope you guys have grabbed a copy, is Mere Christianity. This is, I think, the starting point for Lewis as a Christian writer. Even if you already have a copy of this, I know a lot of you have already read this or already have a copy of it, I would encourage you to grab a copy for this class. If you want to leave it at the table when you leave, you can, but if you've got multiple copies of Mere Christianity, nobody's going to be upset about that either. We're going to be reading through this a little bit later tonight and pulling out some excerpts from it, so I'd encourage you, like I said, just to have a copy there with you at the table. Let's continue with the life of C.S. Lewis. Where we last left Lewis, he had just became a Christian. And I just want to go through a quick timeline of kind of Lewis's life. Because what's really interesting about Lewis in this time of his life, when he becomes a Christian, all of a sudden his life begins to become very stable. Stable in a way that it hadn't been since he was a child. If you'd remember, he lost his mother before he turned 10 years old. And after his mother died, his life just kind of got turned upside down. And it's at this time, when he's right around 33, 34, that his life begins to stabilize again. So in 1925, this is when he was first formally admitted to his fellowship at Magdalen College in Oxford. And this was a huge point for him because, as we talked about last week, he could finally stop living off his dad's money. That was a big deal. Even back then, it was hard for somebody like Lewis to get off of the allowance that his dad was sending to help him pay for school. And so this was a big point. This was his full-time job. That was 1925. In 1926, this is when he first meets J.R.R. Tolkien. And we're going to talk a little bit about today about the relationship between these two men and the way that they were able to encourage one another and build one another up in their writings. In 1929, this is we talked about last week, Arthur Lewis, his father, passed away. And this was a point where he doesn't necessarily acknowledge this, but this is a point where he begins to start thinking about spiritual realities in a new way. In 1930, Lewis, his brother Warney, and Mrs. Moore and her daughter, they moved to this house they called the Kilns, and this is where Lewis would live for most of the rest of his life. And this is that point. You know, I said this is the point where they start to have some stability. This is it. Lewis and his brother are back together again. They're living, finally, they have their own home in the Kilns. They're not renting any longer. And it seems to Lewis that life is starting to kind of settle down. And in 1931, Lewis converts fully to Christianity, seeing Christ as divine and as his Savior. In 1932, we see Lewis's first significant Christian work, The Pilgrim's Regress, was published. The Pilgrim's Regress is not a very well-known work, and it's one that's difficult to read, but you start to see kind of the first Lewis in his infant stages of Christianity, being able to tell a story that is an allegory for Christian truth. In 1933, the Inklings were founded. The Inklings were a group of literature professors and faculty members at Oxford who were also Christians. And we're going to talk about them a little bit today because they are famous for having these huge names, in particular, Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And they would present their works to one another and criticize them and talk and fellowship with one another. We're going to talk a little bit more about them in a little bit. But I just want to give a picture of how even World War II started in 1939, but even still, there was some stability for Lewis. Oxford life didn't change a ton for Lewis, even during the war. While a lot of they had a lot less students because they took them away for the war, the life of the college went on. In 1940, The Problem of Pain was published, and in 1941, the wartime radio talks that would eventually become Mere Christianity began. So that's like a real just a fire hose of like these years in Lewis's life. But what I want to point to is at this point when Lewis becomes a Christian in 1931 and in 1933 when this literary group of literary giants is created, this is when this time of stability really begins for Lewis. And it would go on for about 15 years until about 1947. And this is the peak of when Lewis begins to write so prolifically, becomes a really famous figure even in his own time. And so this is the period from about 1933 to 1947 that we're going to be focusing on today. For 27 years, Lewis worked for Oxford University, but he was actually never technically a professor. He was a fellow, what they called then. And as a fellow, he had a fellowship. His job was to be a tutor, mostly. He would have these one-on-one tutor relationships with a student. And so the student would have like an hour-long tutor period with the professor. He would come to his office, and he would bring an essay that he was going to read aloud to Lewis. He would read the essay aloud to Lewis, and then Lewis would critique it, essentially. Lewis had a reputation of being a pretty harsh critic, especially at first. He kind of like mellowed out as his life as a fellow at Oxford went on. But at the beginning, he had this reputation of really being a very difficult tutor. He would also give open lectures to the university at this time that were open to anybody. They weren't like a class that any students would enroll in, but he would just give these open lectures. And he was famous for just being a very charismatic speaker, one who wouldn't speak from notes, but would just speak freely. And he really emphasized this like speaking to the audience and having almost like a dialogue with them rather than reading or reciting his work. This is kind of a day in the life of Lewis. 7:15, he'd be woken up, and he'd have chapel at Oxford at 8 a.m. At 8:15, he'd have breakfast with the dean of chapel and others. And at 9 a.m., this is when these tutorials would start, and they would go on until the afternoon. In the afternoon, he would go back to the kilns, the home where him and his brother and Mrs. Moore lived. He would work in the garden, he would walk the dog, and he would have time with his family. Later that afternoon, he'd be driven back to the college. Lewis famously did not know how to drive. So he'd be driven back to the college, and then he'd have more tutorials for that evening. And then after dinner, it would just be time for talking. That was his life, and he loved it. So these one-on-one sessions with students, Lewis, like I said, had this his reputation for being a tough critic. But this was because Lewis, the way that he taught was one that he did not want to merely give information to students. But he wanted them to be on this process of discovery for themselves. And so he did not have any patience for the lazier or weaker students, as he would describe it. He didn't see this part of his job as being a tutor as being very fun. He just didn't like it. And so he really enjoyed it when these students would be engaging, when they would have something engaging and critical to say that he could go back and forth with them. His students would later describe him as somebody who just loved debate. But they would also describe him as somebody who kind of fit the stereotypical, like, Oxford bachelor don. He didn't have a very a very great appearance. His brother would talk about how he, like, would wear these carpet slippers in his office and this, like, shabby tweed coat. He would always be smoking either a cigarette or a pipe. When these students came in his office, they would describe his office as just thick with smoke. And he essentially just used his carpet as an ashtray. And so it just left this impression of this man who just didn't care about his outward appearance at all, but just loved debate, loved ideas, and talking about these ideas and concepts with one another. As a teacher and a writer, he was brilliant. And this is like stereotype of these Oxford dons. He had an excellent memory, and he would often play this game with students when they came in for these tutorials, where they would pick a book at random from his bookshelf, read a sentence, and he would then, without seeing, would name the book that it was from and know exactly the context that the sentence was in. And the reason he could do this was because the way that he read and the way that he memorized is that he would break down and completely understand the, like, deep inner logic of a text, which is why he could memorize it so well. And this was also why he could give these lectures without having any kinds of notes and still present this very complex material, because he just knew the logic of what he was presenting so well. Lewis could do this because he was also very extremely well-read. He read everything regarding his chosen subject, which usually was medieval English literature, and he ensured that he understood all the logic of that literature as well, and that's what made him such a good teacher. He would later go on to say that he could explain such complex ideas to others because he had first explained them to himself. He said, "As a professional teacher, I have the gift of explanation." And you will see this as we look through works like Mere Christianity. Lewis's gift is being able to take this abstract topic and break it down into simple terms, often pictures that are much easier for us to understand than often the language is. One of the things I also love about Lewis during this time is he had this explanation. Lewis never typed. He wouldn't type anything. And a lot of times the students would come and they would do their tutorials with him in his office, and they would hear his brother in the background. His brother would be in the room behind them, hunting and pecking. He could only type with his two pointer fingers. My high school typing teacher would be furious. But Warney would hunt and peck. I can't remember exactly. I want to say he said something like 40,000 letters he had written for Lewis by the time Lewis died. And so he would be in the background typing, but Lewis never typed. Lewis only used a pen. And the reason for this, Alistair McGrath wrote this biography on him, and he says this. He says, "Lewis actively chose not to type. This mechanical mode of writing, he believed, interfered with creative process, in that the incessant clacking of the typewriter keys dulled the writer's appreciation of the rhythms and cadences of the English language." Lewis argued that it was essential to appreciate how writing sounded. And Lewis, in particular, used a dip pen. Right, a pen that you could write about four words, and then you had to dip it in the ink again. And it was that four words, pause, dip, that rhythm that he used in order to write. And you can see this as you read his writing. You might not necessarily see it every four words, but you can see the cadence and the rhythm to his writing that gives it an like almost poetry feeling, but not quite feel to it. And Lewis said he would whisper the words ahead of time as he wrote. So he would take, as he was dipping, he'd kind of whisper the next four words and he'd write them out. And that whispering, that saying the words out loud, appreciating how the words sounded, allowed him to write so well. As a lecturer, as I said, Lewis was renowned on Oxford's campus. And he would lecture without notes. And his lectures were, to some sense, theater. They would draw these great crowds, and it would be a performance for him. And they were good enough, in fact, that the university would add to his title these kind of like made-up titles. I don't know if it was just to make him feel better or if it was to make the university feel better about continuing to have him as a lecturer. He was a fellow, but he would also be called things like the university's lecturer on medieval English and things like that. And it's at this time when Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien are very close. How many of you well, let's just do this. This will be easier. How many of you have seen The Lord of the Rings? How many of you have read The Lord of the Rings? Yeah, that's pretty good. I'm happy with that. Lewis and Tolkien have a famous relationship. Now, they've been meeting together since about 1929. 1929 is when they first start meeting together. And Tolkien famously would show up on Lewis's office door every Monday morning just to have tea together, to talk about some of the office politics and whatever other topics that they might be thinking about at the time. But over time, this began to be a group of people. They would bring other people in. And so starting in 1933, at first was Warney, C.S. Lewis's brother, who came in, and he had a real interest in history at the time, French revolutionary history. And so they would come in and they would start bantering about these different topics, but they would start pulling others in. In 1933, again, we get this line from Lewis in a letter to his friend Arthur Greaves, one of his best friends we talked about last week. This is the line he says. He says, "I just had a delightful time reading a children's story by Tolkien." And this story would go on and be published in 1937 as, any guesses? The Hobbit. Tolkien and Lewis would go on to have a friendship that would last for years. And though they would have their conflicts, the most important impact would be the formation of the Inklings. Now, the Inklings have been written about by many people over the last few decades, and they've reached kind of legendary status. After Warney, they would bring in other names. One of the names is Charles Williams. Owen Barfield, who we've talked about already, was in that group. And overall, there's about 19 people who kind of passed in and out of these group of men who would meet together. They would bring a selection of their own works to read aloud, and then the rest would criticize it in a good-natured way. Essentially, this was a group of friends with interests in Christianity and interests in literature, and both of those categories were very broad. The group consistently met to discuss different topics. They would most often meet on Tuesday and Thursday nights. On Tuesday nights, they would gather together, and this would be when works were read aloud and criticized. Whether it was Tolkien's Lord of the Rings or Lewis's Problem of Pain or anything else at the time. They were pretty light and fun and informal meetings. Tolkien at the time actually had a really hard time writing The Lord of the Rings. If you've read any of The Lord of the Rings, you know that it is very, very detailed. And it can take forever to get through as a reader. So I can't imagine what it was like for Tolkien as a writer. If we think of Lewis as a storyteller, Tolkien saw himself more as a world builder. Right? And so it mattered very much to him that all the little details were correct, that the history of the characters that he was writing about was in congruence with one another, that the languages were deep and had background to them, that there was mythology within the mythology. Lewis didn't care so much about that kind of stuff. And you can see it if you look for it. You can see these inconsistencies even in things like Narnia. But Tolkien needed somebody like Lewis to encourage him to keep going when he got bogged down with all these details. There's a quote that was laid out by one of these members of the Inklings later on. One of the members of the Inklings didn't really like the Lord of the Rings, and every time Tolkien would bring it to read it aloud, he would complain about it, and Lewis would just go, "Oh, shut up, Hugo. Come on, Tollers." Tollers was Tolkien's like nickname. Tolkien was very grateful for Lewis. After Lewis's death, Tolkien surmised that he likely never would have finished The Lord of the Rings if Lewis had not continued to be interested and pushed Tolkien to continue the work. Tolkien would almost be overwhelmed by the narrative of everything, whereas Lewis loved the narrative and wanted to see what happened next. So the relationship between these two men was really, really interesting. And if you're interested, there'll be, I think I have it up later tonight, but there's a few different works just on these groups that are really interesting if you're interested in learning more about them. But in 1939, World War II began. And as I said, even though life pretty much stayed the same for Lewis during this time at the college, it did mean that he began to get different opportunities in terms of work. He began to get opportunities to speak in different arenas. He would go and speak on the Royal Air Force bases. And this was something that allowed him to start thinking about how he could communicate these complex doctrines and complex theological topics into really common language for these airmen. And it was during this time that Lewis's fame began to skyrocket. So what we're going to do is we're going to start just kind of walking through Lewis and the works that he created during this time, because this is when Lewis begins to become prolific. The first famous work that he wrote was The Problem of Pain in 1940. And quite simply, Lewis's summary point in this book is that what we call pain, this is Lewis looking at the problem of evil. Why a good God, an all-powerful God, would allow evil to exist. And Lewis's solution, in simple terms, would be that what we call pain actually leads to good in a number of ways, whether that's just a problem of definition or because of God's sovereignty. It talks about free will and how it's a necessity in God's universe and how the evil that we have wrought is actually used by God for the greatest good. And the most famous quote from The Problem of Pain is, "God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world." People have said that the problem of pain is difficult because it looks at pain from an intellectual level. It's not really looking at the emotions of pain, but it's really just kind of, all right, well, what is pain? How does it work? I would suggest, if you ever want to read The Problem of Pain, to also read A Grief Observed. A Grief Observed is Lewis's self-reflections after his wife died later in his life. Lewis was married for about 3 years late in his life, and his wife died, and he goes through and he writes this A Grief Observed, and it's a journey of his, a lot of doubt, a lot of anger comes out, and emotion comes out in this writing, and eventually, through the work, he does return back to God, return back to these things that he knows and trusts in. But it's a really interesting comparison and contrast, right? Because you have, on one hand, this very intellectual look at pain and why a good God would allow pain, but then you see the actual experience of what it looks like when somebody really goes through pain, right? So A Grief Observed is the name of that one. The next thing that would happen would be that Lewis would be hired to, the producer of the BBC radio at the time read A Problem of Pain, and he loved it. And as they were trying to come up with production during the war, they're trying to come up with different shows that they could do on the radio. One of the people decided, okay, well, religion is something that a lot of people are kind of searching for right now. Right? It's the war, people are scared, they don't know what to hold on to, and a lot of people are turning to Christianity. So why don't we do something religious? And so then the conversation turned and said, okay, well, there's this up-and-coming writer, C.S. Lewis. He's an apologist. He takes these topics that are difficult about Christianity, and he kind of puts them in easier terms to understand. Okay, that'd be somebody who'd be really great. So they asked Lewis to come and do a series of talks on BBC Radio, and it was initially It was initially broken into three talks, which were then published as pamphlets: Broadcast Talks, Christian Behavior, and Beyond Personality. And all of these were given from 1941 to 1944. The book that you have in your hands, that is now Mere Christianity, was a compilation of those talks and pamphlets that he edited and then republished in 1952. The reasons for belief, and this is essentially Lewis's summary of Mere Christianity, would be that he's trying to give reasons for people to believe without having to go to the Bible. Essentially, it's like, all right, how can we think about common sense? How can we think about all of our experience with everyday life and still come up with a reason to believe in a God, in a good God, in a God who can give us commands, but also who loves us? Like, how does Christianity come up with this? And so Lewis is looking at this all essentially from like a common sense angle. And it's not a perfect argument for why God must exist or why God must be the God of Christianity, but it is a very helpful one, and it's one of the most influential books of the 20th century, with a really wide number of topics that are broached in it. We're going to get to kind of read through it a little bit later tonight. There are many famous quotes, and we're going to go through some of them, but I think my personal favorite and one that sums up a lot of who Lewis is and how he thought is this: "If I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world." We're going to talk a little bit more about this, but this is the place to start with Lewis. You could argue Narnia. I would actually probably argue Narnia because I love Narnia. But in terms of his just works on Christianity, Mere Christianity is the place to start. And so this is why, even though a lot of you might have already may already have this book, it's one that I think any Christian who is interested in Christian writing, it's something that you should have in your collection. It's worth going through to pull out some nuggets for. So this is Lewis's star is rising at this point, right? It's the middle of World War II. He's become this figure on the radio who thousands, millions listen into. And you know what I should have done is I should have pulled a clip of the audio of him speaking. It's kind of hard to understand because he got a pretty thick British accent, but it's pretty good. Go look it up on Google if you can. His star is rising then during this time, during World War II, but what really kind of cements his status as a star, as a public famous figure, is when the Screwtape Letters are published. And this is actually not 1940, it's 1942 that the Screwtape Letters are published. Again, how many of you have read the Screwtape Letters? Anybody? Or parts of them? Most of you then know that Screwtape Letters are written in the form of a senior demon in hell writing to essentially his underling who is working in the lives of people, right? So it's kind of like it's viewing hell and the spiritual warfare through like this bureaucratic lens. And what's really unique about it, and this is what Lewis was so good at, is he took pretty basic, common Christian doctrine and advice, and he puts it into this really unique framework, right? This idea of one demon giving advice to another demon. And it's through this framework, through this lens, that we start to see truth in a brand new way. And so it cemented Lewis's status as somebody who could do this, who could bring traditional spiritual realities and advice to common people through unique imaginative pictures and illustrations. The entire book is the illustration then of these demons corresponding with one another. This is one of the most famous quotes from it. I'm going to actually read the full quote, which is a little longer. "But do remember," again, this is the older demon speaking to the younger demon, "do remember that the only thing that matters is the extent to which you separate the man from the enemy," the enemy being God, right? These are demons talking. "It does not matter how small the sins are, provided that their cumulative effect is to edge the man away from the light and out into nothing. Murder is no better than cards if cards can do the trick. Indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signposts. Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape." In 1943, Lewis wrote The Abolition of Man. The Abolition of Man is a collection of three lectures that he gave at the time. This is a little more heady of a work. It's a little more philosophical of a work. In this work, he's arguing that contemporary morality had been corrupted because the contemporary intellectuals wanted to make morality relative and subjective to individual experience. This is something that we still get today, correct? Morality, our experience is relative to each person's individual experience. So this is more of a philosophical book than it is a religious book, but it's one with significant Christian influence, both influencing the book itself and that the book can influence to us today. I think it's a pretty difficult book for most readers, but it is one with some significant value if you can work your way through it. This is my personal favorite quote from this. This is Lewis talking about our instinct to want to kind of, I'm just gonna let him say it. You can't go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. To see through all things is the same as not to see. So this idea that if there's ulterior motives behind everything, if everything is just a compilation of something else, then we never have anything concrete. In 1945, Lewis wrote The Great Divorce. And The Great Divorce is another kind of imaginative, reimagining. It's a work of fiction, but it's really an allegory of Christian truth. It's just a new framework through which to view spiritual realities. In this, the question is essentially asked, it's like, all right, well, what would it be like if somebody who was residing in hell got to visit heaven? What kind of conversations would happen between people in heaven and somebody who is visiting from hell? What would happen on his journey to heaven? What would the kind of the mindset of this person be? And it has some really fundamental things to say about pride and about the limits of free will. And there are some things in this work, The Great Divorce, that theologically might be a little suspect. But again, it's the pictures and images that we get from Lewis that allow us to kind of rethink things that are really unique. And the most famous quote from this one: there are only two kinds of people in the end, those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says in the end, "Thy will be done." All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find, and those who knock, it is opened. Finally, and this is the last work we're going to just briefly look at, Miracles was written in 1947, and this is Lewis's attempt to intellectually, rationally say, miracles, supernatural reality, spiritual reality, these things, we shouldn't just disbelieve in these things just because our time is very rational and naturalistic. It's a critique of naturalism, which says, you know, there's nothing but molecules and atoms to reality, and it's a defense of miracles. My personal favorite quote from this is, in science, we have been reading only the notes to a poem. In Christianity, we have the poem itself. Mm-hmm. So it's in these works, these works are Mere Christianity, The Problem of Pain, The Screwtape Letters, The Abolition of Man, The Great Divorce, and Miracles. These works are like the classics of C.S. Lewis, right? They happen during this time from 1933 to 1947. It's kind of this peak time for Lewis. A lot of times if you like go online and you just search for a box set of C.S. Lewis works, it's going to include these seven and maybe one of from later in his life. Here's what I want to do now. We don't obviously have time to like actually look at all of these works. And so I wanted to give you just a brief snapshot of what Lewis focused on throughout a lot of his career. But what I want to do now is I want us to ask the question, how do we, as a 21st century, 2018 people, how do we read C.S. Lewis and read him well? How do we take solid things from what he says? And so I want to just do this. How do we read C.S. Lewis? There are several difficulties in reading Lewis. If any of you have tried to dig in to Surprised by Joy since last week, it's hard to continue to read through it. They are hard things to read, and there's some specific reasons why. One is that there is a lot of just heavy intellectualism in these works. He's an intellectual guy. He's a faculty member at Oxford. He can be difficult to slog through. Another thing is we're thinking about a time in history that was very different from our own, right? These are the 1930s. This is 70, 80 years ago. And there's a couple different things. One is the language, right? The language that Lewis uses sometimes is difficult for us to follow. It takes a lot more, at least for me, it takes a lot more focus to stick through each sentence and really tell what's being said. Partially because it's heavy, it's intellectual, but partially just because the language, the phrases that they use, they're different than what we use today. But some other reasons why the time is different in history is that there are cultural references, right? Lewis references authors, you know, popular topics of conversation at the time, and those kinds of things we today, we're not going to understand what he's referring to. And the other thing, though, is too that he is a product of his time. And so there are certain things in Lewis's works that aren't going to click for us today, especially some of the things, the ways that he talks about women, for example. Now, I think for the most part, if we are fair with Lewis, it's if we give him the benefit of the doubt, it's really not bad. But there are a few instances, a few phrases that if you were to give this book to a non-Christian today, there are some snags in here in the way that he talks, right? He is a product of his time. The political correctness of the 1930s is very different from the political correctness of 2018. And that's not to say that the different political correctness levels were right or wrong. They're just different. And so there are some things that will be snags in there for people. But Lewis has some very specific strengths. Oh, I want to say this too. He wasn't a theologian. Lewis is a layman, right? He's a professor of English literature. He's not a priest. He's not a pastor. He's not somebody who has gone to seminary and learned all this doctrine. He's a layman. He's an incredibly smart layman, but he is a layman. Now, this is a strength as well as a weakness, right? The hard part about this is sometimes, especially in a book like Mere Christianity, you wish you got a little deeper, right? Some of the doctrine isn't quite fleshed out in the way that we might like. But the benefit to that is that he can communicate those things to common, ordinary people in ways that maybe sometimes people in, theologians and pastors just can't. And that's what I want to talk about, the strengths of Lewis. Because like we talked about at the beginning of this class, everybody who influences us is in specific ways. And so when we think about Lewis, we want to think about the ways that he can influence us. And what we're going to see is that they correlate with these same difficulties, right? Yes, Lewis is incredibly smart and he talks like an incredibly smart man. But at the same time, his works have a lot of wit and a lot of just kind of lightness to them that make them a lot easier to read. So in Mere Christianity, you can flip there if you'd like, but it's page 6. Page 7. And essentially, Lewis is just breaking down this idea that none of us live up to a moral standard, right? That we all sin is essentially what he's saying. Page 7, about a third of the way down the page, he says, "None of us are really keeping the law of nature. If there are any exceptions among you, I apologize to them. They had much better read some other book, for nothing I am going to say concerns them. And now, turning to the ordinary human beings who are left." Lewis has this lightness about his work that makes it really just, at least for me, it makes it pleasant to read. So even if there are sections which I just can't get through, eventually I'm going to come to some little nugget that just kind of makes me chuckle. And that makes it a lot easier to read. Another thing that Lewis was really good at is he had a lot of cultural foresight. He could see what was coming in the waves of culture and spoke about them. And that's not necessarily always prevalent in things like Mere Christianity, but especially in some of his heavier works. He could see what was coming in culture. And so even though he is a product of his time, he also was able to see what was coming down the pike and used it in some really powerful ways. But finally, and this is the biggest thing, I think, if you are going to get anything from this class, anything from Lewis, is that he really illustrates how to use images and stories and pictures to communicate complex truth. And so even though he was not a theologian, his work is just powerful. So here are some practical tips. These are just from me, a couple of just really practical tips about reading C.S. Lewis. I would use a highlighter or a pencil or a pen, something, when you're reading his works, even if you just want to use sticky notes to mark certain paragraphs or quotes, because Lewis has these nuggets of truth, these quotes that are just so powerful, these images that are so powerful. I know some people don't like to write in their books. That's okay. Use like a sticky note or something. But it helps me to focus as I'm reading it, and it also helps me to go back and say, okay, well, what did I get from this book? oh, here's a great quote or image that I can pull out of that. Another thing is, don't be afraid to skip sections that you just can't get, because there will be those. Lewis himself says, actually in Mere Christianity, in one of the later chapters, he says this: "It is a very silly idea that in reading a book, you must never skip. All sensible people skip freely when they come to a chapter which they find is going to be no use to them." And then at the end of that chapter, he says, "This idea has helped me a good deal. If it does not help you, leave it alone." If he can be that upfront about his own work, then we can be that honest too. There will be parts of his works that just aren't helpful to us, and it's okay to skip through those and skip to the nuggets that do kind of touch our hearts and help us see things in a new way. And then finally, my last just practical advice would be to keep going. Again, if you need to skip, then skip, but keep going until you find some chunk that grabs your attention, because there are just some profound chunks, and we're going to see that in a few minutes. But before we do that, I want to ask the question, okay, well, this is how we read C.S. Lewis, but what do we read? Where do we start? We just read 7 books that are kind of his, like, big books, but even there, I don't know where to start. I'm going to actually let some more intelligent people talk about that than me.
Any favorites in Lewis that you would just wave a flag, don't miss this one? What's been the most pleasing book to read? One that you've been most satisfied by? Or do you have a genre? You like fiction or the essays and the...
If I was actually teaching a course, I'd probably have to think, well, what would be the best way in?
Yeah.
But I haven't, and so I haven't done that thinking. I find that Lewis... Kathy and I actually believe it's important to just read everything, mm-hmm. because it seems like he can't write something that is uninteresting or unhelpful.
Or unexemplary, that's
it's
right.
Right, and so actually, I'll tell you what I like. I like all the various collections of these little essays, yep. Or little talks here, or intros to this book, or right. Even the introduction to Paradise Lost is fascinating. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I actually like, instead of the classics, I actually like to go and find all these gems that nobody else has found, because right. they're in these out-of-the-way places in his writings.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe wrapping it up, there is this so-called movement of young Reformed resurgence or New Calvinism or YRR. What could they benefit from most from Lewis? If we sicked them on Lewis and said, read as much as you can, what would we be hoping they would experience?
Well, Edwards was not the king of illustrations, he was the king of images. Hmm. Edwards knew how to turn the ear into an eye. In other words, he's not going to just say justification, he's going to, when he says, your good deeds cannot keep you out of hell any more than a spider web can stop a falling rock. Mm-hmm. So instead of just telling you, you'll never save yourself through your good works, he throws in an image, and it's just incredible.
Yeah.
Not illustrations, not
stories.
Right, no, images.
Right.
Whereas Lewis is the illustration king. Mm-hmm. And I just think if you're Reformed, ignore the places, maybe even hold your nose at places where he praises George MacDonald or suggests that maybe there is such a thing as purgatory, though I don't think he believed that, but he's mm-hmm. a couple places where he talks like that. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about that. Just look at how he illustrates Christian truth. He can't say anything without throwing in 3 or 4 sparkling illustrations,
right.
and
right.
it is so important to do that.
That's right.
And Edwards knew the same thing. The way to touch the heart is you have to have illustrations and images. You have to take the abstract truth, propositional truth, and actually you clarify the proposition by taking it into the realm of the concrete.
Yeah.
The concrete realm is illuminated by the proposition. The proposition is better understood. There was one place where Flannery O'Connor was once asked, could you put your story into a nutshell? What was just one sentence? She says, if I could put it in one sentence, I wouldn't have had to write the story. And what she meant was that I can put it in a sentence, but you wouldn't understand that sentence as well if you didn't have the whole story. And so Lewis is the way that I learn how to do that.
Yep. Let's close with just giving some direction to the folks who might be watching about where they could go. So we get these clusters of books. talk about just I'm thinking Narnia, I'm thinking Space Trilogy, I'm thinking Miracles, Problem of Pain. Where should they go? What's out there as a place to jump in?
I would do Mere Christianity, I'd do the Screwtape Letters, I would do The Great Divorce, and I would do The Chronicles of Narnia. And when it comes to his more of his essay, I would do Abolition of Man. And I think there you have the picture of Mere Christianity, which is a straightforward exposition of, you know, why you should believe. Screwtape Letters and Great Divorce is a beautiful example of something in the middle, not stories, but an imaginative way of getting Christian truth across. When you get to the Chronicles of Narnia, it's out and out myth and story. And Abolition of Man is a great, is one of those places where you can see he saw what was coming in Western civilization, and he's kind of just giving you his, as a great essayist, he's just telling you what's right and what's wrong.
Great advice. Thank you.
Okay.
So in case you weren't able to write all that down, Keller essentially lists out these five works. As he says, this is where we should start. Mere Christianity, Screwtape Letters, The Great Divorce, all of the Chronicles of Narnia, which I'm like, yes, and The Abolition of Man. I would also add the Weight of Glory is a collection of sermons and essays by his that are really profound. If you're interested in the life of Lewis, some biographies that I think are very helpful. C.S. Lewis, A Life, is the one that I've been primarily reading, which is very good, written just a few years ago by Alistair McGrath. Another one that has been recommended to me that I haven't actually written are these other two, C.S. Lewis, A Companion and Guide by Walter Hooper, who did some typing and things for Lewis during his lifetime. And then The Narnian, The Life and Imagination of C.S. Lewis by Alan Jacobs. Some other resources, just if you're curious at all, there's this book that came out a couple years ago called C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, A Biography. And it's a biography of a book. So it's how did Mere Christianity come about? It's by George Marsden. The Fellowship, The Literary Lives of the Inklings came out in, I think, 2016. And that's about, again, that literary group. And then if you just Google search Desiring God 2013 C.S. Lewis, you will find they had a national conference that was all on C.S. Lewis, and all of the videos from that conference are available online. They have them available on their website. You just Google Desiring God 2013 C.S. Lewis or something like that. It's the first thing that comes up. And then Piper and Keller have a couple more videos like that where they're just talking about C.S. Lewis together. That's John Piper and Tim Keller, and those are really, at least for me, I really enjoy them because I really like both of those guys and C.S. Lewis. There you go. So that's where I would start. But what I want to do for the next few minutes is to kind of walk through some of Mere Christianity and get a taste of how Lewis writes his Christian works with one another. But what I want to do before that is to give you a brief minute to catch your breath, to refill on coffee or water or anything else you might need, and then we'll start digging into Mere Christianity. So we'll just take about 2 minutes, okay? All right. As you kind of flip open your books to the first few pages, we're gonna just start in the preface of Mere Christianity, because Lewis explains to us what he's trying to do with this book and what exactly he means by Mere Christianity. And one of the things he is specifically trying to do with this work is he says, all right, well, all these different denominations and divisions of Christianity, what do they all have in common? And you know, he's got some great things to say in these first few pages. He says, one of the things Christians are disagreed about is the importance of their disagreements. That's a good line. And essentially, what he's trying to say is not that denominations and different distinctions in what we believe aren't important, but that all of us have certain things in common, and it's the things that we have in common that are the most central. And so when we're starting with people who are unbelievers, the best place to start is with what we all have in common, right? We're not going to take somebody who doesn't believe and argue with them why tulip is the best way to go, right? Or why they need to believe in predestination. Like that is not the level that we want to start when we're talking about Christianity. And so I think Lewis has it right that this is the best place to start, this Mere Christianity, the thing that we all have in common. But what's really, I think, interesting that he says about this is on the pages XV, which I believe is 15 in Roman numeral. So if you could turn there. He has something very important to say about this idea of mere Christianity. And what he wants to say is, this isn't the place that you stop. This is the place where you start, but not the place where you stop. It's not that the divisions and denominations aren't important. It's just not where you start. We're going to start a couple lines into that second paragraph there. It is more like, and this is it being mere Christianity, says, it is more like a hall out of which doors open into several rooms. If I can bring anyone into that hall, I shall have done what I attempted. But it is in the rooms, not in the hall, that there are fires and chairs and meals. The hall is a place to wait in, a place from which to try the various doors, not a place to live in. For that purpose, the worst of the rooms, whichever that may be, is, I think, preferable. It is true that some people may find they have to wait in the hall for a considerable time, while others feel certain almost at once which door they must knock at. I do not know why there is this difference, but I am sure God keeps no one waiting unless he sees that it is good for him to wait. When you do get into your room, you will find that the long wait has done you some kind of good, which you would not have had otherwise. But you must regard it as waiting, not as camping. You must keep on praying for light, and of course, even in the hall, you must begin trying to obey the rules which are common to the whole house. And above all, you must be asking which door is the true one, not which pleases you best by its paint and paneling. In plain language, the question should never be, do I like that kind of service? But are these doctrines true? Is holiness here? Does my conscience move me towards this? Is my reluctance to knock at this door due to my pride or my mere taste or my personal dislike of this particular doorkeeper? When you have reached your own room, be kind to those who have chosen different doors and to those who are still in the hall. If they are wrong, they need your prayers all the more, and if they are your enemies, then you are under orders to pray for them. That is one of the rules common to the whole house. So this mere Christianity that Lewis is expressing in this book, he's not advocating that we should quit being Catholic or quit being Protestant or quit being Reformed or quit being Baptist, that we should just all get along. That's not his point. His point is that what is common to all of us is where we need to start. Turn in your books to page 3, which is after the foreword here. Lewis begins this apologetic work by setting up this idea that all humans have a standard of morality that we adhere to, that we understand exists, that there's some kind of standard that we all expect one another to keep. We're just going to read this first paragraph or two here. Everyone has heard people quarreling. Sometimes it sounds funny, and sometimes it sounds merely unpleasant, but however it sounds, I believe we can learn something very important from listening to the kind of things they say. They say things like this: how'd you like it if anyone did the same to you? That's my seat. I was there first. Leave him alone. He isn't doing you any harm. Why should you shove in first? Give me a bit of your orange. I gave you a bit of mine. Come on, you promised. People say things like that every day, educated people as well as uneducated, and children as well as grown-ups. Now, what interests me about all these remarks is that the man who makes them is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He is appealing to some kind of standard of behavior which he expects the other man to know about. And the other man very seldom replies, "To hell with your standard." Nearly always he tries to make out that what he has been doing does not really go against the standard, or that if it does, there is some special excuse. So this is Lewis's building block, and he's gonna build from this. But this is the foundation that all of us believe in fairness. We all believe in telling the truth, in being honest. We believe that humility is a virtue. There are certain things that we all believe, some kind of standard of morality that everyone, from a Christian to a non-Christian, adheres to. And so what he's appealing is to this natural standard of morality, a standard of fairness and justice. And so he goes on to say that even if the standard isn't necessarily written down, even if we're not even explicitly taught it, it's something that we all implicitly hold and refer to. Now, something that Lewis addresses is this idea. You can turn to page 6. This idea that, well, some might say society is the one that sets these values. It's something that has evolved as different societies have rules that bind everybody together. But Lewis says that even if you trace the history of different societies and nations around the world, you'll find core values that are shared among all of them. So we're starting about a third of the way down the page. Think of a country where people were admired for running away in battle, or where a man felt proud of double-crossing all the people who had been kindest to him. You might just as well try to imagine a country where 2 and 2 made 5. Men have differed as regards to what people you ought to be unselfish to, whether only your own family or your fellow countrymen or everyone, but they have always agreed that you ought not to put yourself first. Selfishness has never been admired. Men have differed as to whether you should have 1 wife or 4, but they have always agreed that you must not simply have any woman that you liked. And so if we get to this point with Lewis, we get to this point where we recognize that there is a standard of morality, then even more so, Lewis says, now we recognize that we don't live up to that standard of morality. Look on that next page, page 7. Again, about a third of the way down the page. He says, none of us, no, we read that part already, sorry, half the way down the page. He says, I hope you will not misunderstand what I am saying. I'm not preaching, and heaven knows I do not pretend to be better than anyone else. I'm only trying to call attention to a fact, the fact that this year or this month, or more likely this very day, we have failed to practice ourselves the kind of behavior we expect from other people. There may be all sorts of excuses for us. That time you were so unfair to the children was when you were very tired. That slightly shady business about the money, the one you have almost forgotten, came when you were very hard up. And what you promised to do for old so-and-so and have never done, well, you never would have promised if you had known how frightfully busy you were going to be. And as for your behavior to your wife or husband or sister or brother, if I knew how irritating they could be, I would not wonder at it. And who the dickens am I, anyway? I am just the same. That is to say, I do not succeed in keeping the law of nature very well. And the moment anyone tells me that I am not keeping it, there starts up in my mind a string of excuses as long as your arm. And so he sums up everything in this last paragraph here. These, then, are the 2 points I want to make. First, that human beings all over the earth have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way, and they cannot really get rid of it. Secondly, that they do not, in fact, behave that way. They know the law of nature, they break it. These 2 facts are the foundation of all clear thinking about ourselves and the universe we live in. And so Lewis says, this is the thing that we have to accept, both for ourselves, but also if we're going to share the truth and beauty of Christianity with other people, it's this reality that we first have to share with one another. Go ahead and turn to page 32. I think he puts this in a really beautiful way. About 2/3 down the page. Of course, I quite agree that the Christian religion is, in the long run, a thing of unspeakable comfort. But it does not begin in comfort. It begins in the dismay I have been describing. And it is no use at all trying to go on to that comfort without first going through that dismay. In religion, as in war and everything else, comfort is the one thing you cannot get by looking for it. If you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth. Only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin with. And in the end, despair. We have to see this harsh reality, Lewis says, that we do not live up to the own standard that we set for other people in order to accept the comfort that Christianity is offering. So this is the first book of his Mere Christianity. That's got 3 more left. Book 2, you'll see there, is what Christians believe. And essentially what Lewis is offering in this second book is saying, okay, well, what is the Christian answer then to this problem? Some other philosophies or religion might posit different answers. He talks about dualism. And so he says this spiritual idea that, well, there's this like eternal conflict between good and evil going on in the world from the beginning of time until the end. And it's something that we see play out all the time. And he says, okay, well Christianity does, there's some truth to that, but there's also some differences. And one of the big differences, he says, is that the evil that we see in Christianity, this is a battle of good and evil, but the evil actually came from the good. In Christianity, we see a world in which the evil rebelled against the good. So turn to page 45. I think this is a really unique picture of Christianity that is helpful to me. At the bottom of the page on 45, it says, Christianity agrees with dualism that the universe is at war. But it does not think this is a war between independent powers. It thinks it is a civil war, a rebellion, and that we are living in a part of the universe occupied by the rebel. Enemy-occupied territory, that is what this world is. Christianity is the story of how the rightful king has landed. He's landed in this enemy-occupied territory. You might say landed in disguise, and is calling us all to take part in a great campaign of sabotage. When you go to church, you are really listening in to the secret wireless from our friends. That is why the enemy is so anxious to prevent us from going. He does it by playing on our conceit and laziness and intellectual snobbery. I know someone will ask me, do you really mean, at this time of day, to reintroduce our old friend the devil? Hoofs and horns and all? Well, what the time of day has to do with it, I do not know. And I am not particular about the hoofs and horns. But in other respects, my answer is, yes, I do. I do not claim to know anything about his personal appearance. If anybody really wants to know him better, I would say to that person, don't worry, if you really want to, you will. Whether you'll like it or not, when you do, is another question. This idea that the world we live in is in rebellion against God and that we are subverting that rebellion is, I think, a really powerful image. And it's this a great example, I think, of how Lewis paints these pictures of traditional, timeless Christian truths in new ways. So if that evil attempted to spread rebellion to creation, if the evil of Satan and sin attempted to spread rebellion across creation, by convincing, this is how they do it, Lewis says. Lewis says that they attempted to spread evil by convincing human beings that the greatest good, God, was insufficient to satisfy their greatest longings. Just turn a couple pages over to page 49. He continues with this idea and continue to talk about Satan and evil. And he says at near the bottom of page 49, what Satan put into the heads of our remote ancestors was the idea that they could be like gods, could set up their own as if they had created themselves, be their own masters, invent some sort of happiness for themselves outside God, apart from God. And out of that hopeless attempt has come nearly all that we call human history. Money, poverty, ambition, war, prostitution, classes, empires, slavery. The long, terrible story of man trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. So if this is the way in which the enemy is trying to subvert the rightful king, then Lewis goes on to, throughout this second section, to explain what it is that Christ offers to contrast that. And that he offers forgiveness, he offers new life. And because he offers that forgiveness and new life, Christians can believe in certain principles, right? He gives commands, he gives moral obligation to Christians along with that new life. Turn to page 63. He says Christians can come into this new life, but in order to do that, they have to take on a certain kind of death. And this is about a quarter of the way down the page. A live body is not one that never gets hurt, but one that can, to some extent, repair itself. In the same way, a Christian is not a man who never goes wrong, but a man who is enabled to repent and pick himself up and begin over again after each stumble. Because the Christ life is inside him, repairing him all the time, enabling him to repeat, in some degree, the kind of voluntary death which Christ himself carried out. And then he explains why then Christians can say, all right, well, this moral code that you're calling to God, how are we even able to do this? And this is what he says. That is why the Christian is in a different position from other people who are trying to be good. They hope, by being good, to please God, if there is one, or if they think there is not, at least they hope to deserve approval from good men. This is talking about non-Christians, right? They're hoping that maybe they can please God, or at least they can please one another. But the Christian thinks any good he does comes from the Christ life inside him. He does not think God will love us because we are good, but that God will make us good because he loves us. Just as the roof of a greenhouse does not attract the sun because it is bright, but becomes bright because the sun shines on it. And the reason Lewis is talking about this, remember, he started off saying, all right, there's a same system of morals, this common standard of morality that we all adhere to, but we can't live up to it. Christianity offers forgiveness, but also offers new life in which you can start to live up to that moral standard, but really it's Christ inside you living up to it. And then he moves through this middle set, this third book, which we're not going to read any quotes from, but Christian Behavior is book three. And this is one which I will tell you now, you might want to skip over some. There's one section that's like, what is it? Morality and psychoanalysis. It might be a little bit of a slog to work through. But there are some nuggets in there. But you might want to skip some sections in this. But I do think that all of these chapters, if you look at these chapters in book three, there's social morality, Christian marriage, forgiveness. The one is entitled The Great Sin, and that one's on pride. That is a fantastic chapter on pride, and I would really recommend it. Hope, faith, all of these Christian ideals, Christian morals that we should live up to. And he gives some practical reasons saying, look, these are things that, it's not just like Christianity coming up with these standards that are just arbitrary. There's some real practical reasons why Christian following of these morals looks different and why they're so helpful for us. So those are great chapters that you can really read kind of separately. You can just read them on their own, and I would encourage you to do so. The last quote I would like us to look at, though, is on 197. And we're going to end for tonight on this one. The final book in Mere Christianity is titled Beyond Personality, or First Steps in the Doctrine of the Trinity. And it's kind of like, you know, it's the pinnacle of how do we actually do this? How do we accept this new life as Christians? And the big thing that he wants to get across in these last few chapters is that in order to come into the life of Christ, we must give up something. We must give up everything. At the bottom of page 197, the terrible thing, the almost impossible thing, is to hand over your whole self, all your wishes and precautions to Christ. But it is far easier than what we are all trying to do instead. For what we are trying to do is to remain what we call ourselves, to keep personal happiness as our great aim in life, and yet at the same time be good. We are all trying to let our mind and heart go their own way, centered on money or pleasure or ambition, and hoping, in spite of this, to behave honestly and chastely and humbly. And that is exactly what Christ has warned us you could not do. As he said, a thistle cannot produce figs. If I am a field that contains nothing but grass seed, I cannot produce wheat. Cutting the grass may keep it short, but I shall still produce grass and no wheat. If I want to produce wheat, the change must go deeper than the surface. I must be plowed up and re-sown. And this is what Lewis says Christianity is asking. The title of this chapter is Christianity hard or easy? And Lewis says both. He says both. It is hard. It's hard to be completely plowed up and re-sown into being a new being. But it is so much easier than trying to go through life constantly trying to live up to a standard that we'll never reach. I would encourage you to try and make it through this book at least once. to like I said earlier, to just to keep going until you get through, to find the nuggets in here that are helpful to you. Because it is a classic. It is one that has a lot of foundational truth. Now, here's my little pitch. Next week, we're going to talk about Narnia. I love Narnia. I love it. How many of you in here have read even parts of the Chronicles of Narnia? All right, a lot of us. Good. That'll give us a good place to start. How many of you have a copy of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at home? A lot of us. Okay. So here's the I got to figure out what book I want to give you next week. I'm definitely going to bring some Narnia. I might bring some other ones too. We're going to walk through a lot of Narnia next week, but I think, and again, this is Lewis's sweet spot, is how do I communicate truth, profound truth that tells us something about God in ways that people can not only understand, but in ways that will stick. And he does this very uniquely in Narnia, but also his other primary fiction work, which is, you might know as the Space Trilogy, which is, it's written for adults, so it's a little more complex than Narnia, but also has some really profound truth in it. I'm very excited about that. I don't know if you can tell, but Ashley's been like, I have to read like a chapter of Narnia every night before I go to bed for like the last couple weeks. It's like, oh my gosh, you're gonna read again? It's like 12:30. I know. But the nice thing about Narnia, they're very short chapters. It's like a page and a half, so it's good. I'm very excited about that. I hope we'll see you guys here next week. But if you wouldn't mind, would you bow your heads in prayer with me? Dear Lord, we thank you so much for the people that you have given us in our lives that have influenced us. Lord, we thank you for different people's strengths and weaknesses that fill in the cracks for us, Lord, that we can strive to be more like you through the example that we see in people who have loved you, Lord, and have made you a part of their life, that have been plowed up and re-sown in the light of Christ. And we thank you for Lewis, Lord, and we thank you for the way that this man was able to weave your truth into images and illustrations that help us to understand and to appreciate at a new level. Lord, we love you, and we thank you. And we ask that in all of this, as we look to a man, we would remember that what we are really admiring is your work through him. In your son's name we pray. Amen.